on this week's lyric feature, Music, Romanticism and the Sublime. Sometime between the 1780s and the 1820s, something changed forever in European culture. And nowhere was this more apparent than in its music. In this three-part series, Michael Lee explores the changing world of music in the Romantic era and its transcendent idea, the sublime. This is episode one, The Revolutionary Sublime.
Music from the opening of Joseph Haydn's oratorio, The Creation. The sounds we hear seem to be suggesting something, expressing something, as if there's something we need to understand. Music wasn't always like this, and I'd like to have a look at how this idea that music could be expressive on its own terms came to be. To do that, we have to turn back the clock. We like to imagine that every generation has its moment, its special contribution to our ongoing story. To an extent, that's very true, of course, but when we look at the story of European culture, something very strange happens up to the end of the 18th century through to the first quarter of the 19th, that time we now label as the Romantic era. It wasn't just a time of change, more like one of complete transformation. The effects were as wide as they were profound, encompassing not only political and social revolution, but really a complete change of values, ideas that are with us still. It's actually so much part of our makeup that it's hard to pin down. Looking back, the values of the Baroque, that respect for knowledge, skill, virtue, good order, remained. But alongside them grew a new veneration for idealism, for those battling against insurmountable odds, for belief in an inner spirit, and above all, the power of the imagination, of willing new worlds into existence. Through this, we see a new sense of perspective emerging, an awe for the power of the natural world, a respect for local traditions and cultures, and a new feeling for the past. The world suddenly had more meaning, and the art form that changed the most, and had the most to offer, it seemed, was music. It's not as if our ancestors woke up one morning in 1760 or thereabouts and declared, "Oh my goodness, I have feelings." But it was certainly a time which presented what we might call enhanced sensibilities. German writers like Klopstock would talk of the empfindsame Stil, the sensitive style. Even the Venetian playwright Carlo Goldoni, writing in the 1750s, introduces a play of his by saying, "This is a comedy in which feelings are handled with as much vigor and as much delicacy as would be required in a tragedy, because the human heart is more readily moved by the depiction of events of which it has experience." In other words, he's talking about empathy, seen, moreover, as a means of improving people. And these literary ideas began affecting musicians as well. We see this especially in the work of some of the composers attached to the Berlin court of Frederick the Great, people like Karl Heinrich Graun, and most especially Carl Philipp Emanuel Bach, son of the great Johann Sebastian. Thank you. Anna Maria Markovina playing the Andante and Vivace, the middle and a bit of the last movements of the sonata in F, the first of the so-called Prussian sonatas by Emanuel Bach. Bach was a phenomenal keyboard player, and on top of all the music he composed, also compiled the first proper guide to the instrument, his essay on the true art of playing keyboard instruments. Despite the fact that he'd trained on the harpsichord and organ, and the forte piano was still only in its experimental phase at this time, it's testimony to Bach's wisdom and forward-looking approach that this guide happily skipped over into the age of the piano and was indeed still being consulted over a century later. Beethoven loved it, absolutely swore by it. As well as nitty-gritty issues such as insisting on correct and consistent fingering, always a good idea, Bach could also take a broader view and talk about interpretation, instilling what can only be described as a philosophy of performance with such words of advice as this. Since a musician cannot move others unless he himself is moved, he must, of necessity, feel all of the effects that he hopes to arouse in his listeners. So the music alone can't be taken for granted as something self-contained or automatic. It has to be played, understood by the player, and interpreted for the listener, because there's something there that needs to be communicated. If you get the feeling that music around this time and later is becoming less religious and more philosophical, you're not the only one. The issue of sensitivity and the need to interpret music, always important, is now vital. The sense is slowly emerging that music can do or be something in itself, rather than simply describe or amplify a text or a ritual. Music can surprise, can irritate, can move us. Listening can be an experience all in itself, even to the point of terror, which was certainly the intention here, as Don Juan finally meets his maker and is cast into hellfire and damnation at the end of this ballet by Gluck.
We'll be right back.
The closing scene of the ballet Don Juan by Christoph Gluck, the dance of the spectres as performed by Il Giardino Armonico, directed by Giovanni Antonini. On stage, graves fly open and the flames of hell rise up as the dawn falls into the abyss. But the purpose of this music is not really to accompany or depict that. It's primarily to evoke fear in those listening, adding a visceral shiver to the proceedings. The 18th century was a time that presented many terrors and uncertainties, from earthquakes in Portugal to volcanic eruptions in Italy, while the philosophes of Paris steadily chipped away at all the old assumptions of the natural and political world. People's imaginations were being stretched. They were no longer armed by religion to quite the same extent as before, but were still awaiting rational scientific explanations. Eventually, of course, a string of bad harvests, another natural hazard, would prove the straw that broke the camel's back as far as French absolutism was concerned, ushering in the greatest socio-political firestorm of them all, the French Revolution. In the arts, the sensitive style led to sentimental drama, the power of which we should never underestimate. Parallel with this, however, was a trend that aimed at more shocking effects, the revenge dramas of the 1770s and 80s that came under the general category of Sturm und Drang, or storm and stress. This term caused all sorts of ripples, even in music, where a few composers tried to evoke the shock factor with the use of angular themes, striking instrumentation, and placing unusual prominence on minor keys. Gluck got in early with the ballet scene we just heard there, but before long, Haydn and Mozart were exploring these expressive possibilities too.
Thank you.
The jagged opening of Mozart's Symphony No. 25 in G minor, played for us there by the Prague Chamber Orchestra under Charles Mackerras. It's possible to argue that music was tending towards a philosophical idea of art and perception that was itself steadily advancing through the 18th century, namely, the sublime. This was a concept that had been coined by the ancient Romans to describe how the power of poetry and rhetoric could move listeners, the feeling of wonder and astonishment that can overwhelm an audience. Like so many classical ideas, it was rediscovered in the Renaissance, quite late in this case. It inspired some interest, but the idea of the sublime really only began to take off with the publication in the 1750s of A Philosophical Inquiry into the Origin of Our Ideas of the Sublime and the Beautiful by the Irish philosopher Edmund Burke. As the title suggests, he is careful to distinguish between the precious, transient and finite pleasures of the beautiful on the one hand and the transcendent, timeless qualities of the sublime on the other. These days we tend to muddle these terms, with sublime being just a posh way of describing something extra special. But in this context, the sublime is much harder to place. It can be frightening. Terrifying even, like a glimpse of the infinite power of nature, the experience of perceiving something seemingly formless and incomprehensible. It's no accident that journeys in the mountains, for example, once considered horrific and to be avoided if at all possible, came into their own in the Romantic era as people suddenly wanted to experience that sense of grandeur and distance for themselves. The German philosopher Immanuel Kant wrote about all this as well, in some depth, and he was especially interested in picking apart that bit in Burke's title about it being our idea. For Kant, there was no magic about this. An object alone couldn't be beautiful or sublime. It only became so because of the way it was perceived. That was the key. And so the balance of energy falls on the subjective impression experienced by us, by the viewer, that what we get out of something is what we bring to it. Thus, the sublime reflects the moment when our imagination encounters something so extraordinary that it is beyond its control, and thus invites us to redraw our mental boundaries, as it were, to enlarge our personal universe and understand the natural world afresh. Of all art forms, then, the one that offers the most powerful analogy to this is the one that takes up no physical space at all: music. It's no surprise, then, that the sounds that begin to emerge at this time are themselves pushing at the boundaries of the imagination. Commissioned in 1797 to compose an oratorio on the subject of the creation, Joseph Haydn remembered the tone painting of the Handel oratorios he'd heard in London and looked to extend this even further and create something new. It's there from the very start. The prelude, we heard some of it at the start of the program, is entitled The Representation of Chaos.
Thank you.
Nikolaus Arnoncourt conducting Concertus Musicus Vienna with the opening of Haydn's Creation. All is dark, formless, until God says, let there be light, and the crumbling uncertainties of C minor, with all those deferred cadences we were listening to, suddenly transform into a resplendent, blazing C major that swept its first audiences to their feet with excitement and amazement. A simple contrast, and yet, put in that context, what an effect. More would follow where that came from, and indeed, more was to be heard already. For many at the time, the French Revolution was certainly sublime in every sense. It was terrifying, unprecedented, and yet offered the prize of something unknown, the promise of freedom. Don Giovanni in Mozart's opera had mockingly toasted it just a couple of years before, but now liberty was on the loose. One composer who stayed in Paris, having arrived before the revolution, and who somehow survived the reign of terror and everything else to emerge the other side as probably the most powerful figure in French music, was the ever-adaptable Luigi Cherubini. His music may not be heard so often nowadays, but it's worth remembering he was the only composer amongst his contemporaries that Beethoven had any time for. July of 1791 saw the premiere of Cherubini's extraordinary rescue opera Lodowiska. Set in Poland, it involves radical Tatar warriors, a notorious baron who has poor Lodowiska locked away, at her late father's request, mind you, and her dashing lover Floreski, who's come to find and free her. The Tatars plan to destroy the baron's castle, and eventually succeed in spectacular fashion, liberating Lodowiska in the process. 4 days before this opera had its premiere, Parisians had enthusiastically marked the second anniversary of the storming of the Bastille, an event visibly echoed in the drama of the closing scene of this opera. Not only did the dramatic action on stage evoke the Republican fight for freedom, one critic, writing several years later, noted that Cherubini's score created a revolution in French music as well. The new Republican celebrations, like this Bastille anniversary, were noisy, crowded affairs, quite unlike anything that had been seen before the revolution. The people, swaying together, shouted and chanted slogans, and then out of the swirl of noise, a song might start. And soon all the voices came together and rose as one. It was visceral, spine-tingling, emotional, sublime. How could you recapture that mood? Musical drama from now on had to take account of the emotional current of a scene. And for some, that's what Cherubini achieved with his Symphonie Guerrière, the martial symphony that's played as the castle walls are torn apart and the warriors charge in.
des crimes. Tu ne joindras pas, tu ne joindras pas les Français.
Parmi les victimes, voilà mon prix cruel, voilà mon prix cruel.
The voice of Lodoïska being led towards the light, free at last. Nathalie Manfrino and Sébastien Guez with Les Éléments, directed by Jeremy Rohrer in that recording. This opera would later inspire Beethoven to compose a rescue opera of his own, the mighty Fidelio. In this context, though, thinking of music that evokes and indeed sought to inspire the power of both the imagination and the emotions in this turbulent period, we need to look instead to Beethoven's Third Symphony. The story of this work is well known, that Beethoven originally intended to call it simply Bonaparte, dedicating it to the great Napoleon, only to rip out the dedication on hearing the news that Bonaparte had crowned himself Emperor of France. For Beethoven, this was an act of unforgivable betrayal. This music retains one of the great revolutionary moments in all music, when in the development section of the first movement, the build-up of tension in both rhythm and harmony leads to a sequence of stressed chords, eventually bursting into repeated crashing dissonances with what some commentators call the revolutionary chord. It is as if one note, the E, is trying to free itself, and does so, leading to a new theme in E minor, a key unrelated to what has gone before, leading us in a new direction. You can't see any of that without the score in your hands, but to hear it is always riveting, engrossing, disturbing even. Just imagine how it would have sounded back in 1804 when it was first heard.
Thank you.
And so back to the opening theme, we return, battered and bruised, but hopefully invigorated as well. With music from the opening movement of Beethoven's Third Symphony, we heard the ensemble Anima Aeterna, directed by Jos van Immerseel. We take Beethoven's symphonic music so much for granted now that it's easy to forget the difficulties it presented. Beethoven himself found that section of the Third Symphony very hard to conduct at the work's premiere. Later on, his Ninth Symphony would make even greater demands on performers and audiences and on the very idea of how an orchestral ensemble should perform together. If any one work contributed to the development of the modern orchestra into the mid-19th century, it indeed would have to be Beethoven's Ninth, with all its complexities and challenges, a fascinating story in itself. The idea of the revolutionary sublime, of stretching people's expectations and taking one to new worlds, certainly didn't stop with the return of the French monarchy. If anything, the failed promise of Napoleonic idealism was just the start. One vital musical philosopher and practitioner of the post-Napoleonic generation was an actual native Frenchman, Hector Berlioz, who admired Beethoven deeply. The Paris he came to know was by now bereft of firebrands, and for him at least, a place of stultifying conservatism, the chief culprit being none other than the aging Cherubini himself. While the new cultural institutions may have enjoyed some measure of newfound autonomy, they certainly didn't behave like it, and it was Berlioz who, in a way, had to instigate a few revolutions of his own. He's best known for his boundless idealism as a composer, matched only by the critical focus he was able to deliver as a journalist and concert reviewer. To hear this creative imagination in action, we need only turn to his setting of the Requiem, or Grande Messe des Morts, first heard in 1837, and in particular the Dies Irae sequence. This text, a medieval hymn, usually functions as a liturgical meditation on the last day, the day of judgment, when a trumpet will summon souls before the throne of God, the saved, delivered, and the damned cast down into eternal hellfire. It is a dramatic text and deeply moving in its original plain chant setting. Composers in the past, notably Mozart, certainly exploited the poetry's energy to good effect, but Berlioz wants to go several stages further. His setting is not a reflection so much as an immersion, seeking to bring the day of judgment into the present. There's not just one trumpet, but four brass ensembles situated at the four cardinal points around the auditorium, creating a rare and potentially deafening quadraphonic effect, in addition to the choir and remainder of the orchestra on stage, supplemented by as many kettle drums, timpani, as possible. The effect is extraordinary.
Thank you.
Music from Berlioz's Requiem, performed by the London Symphony Orchestra and Chorus under Colin Davis. The words sung there, "Death and all nature will both marvel where all creation arises to answer before the judge." Berlioz clearly saw that as a challenge, looking to take us into the heart of that terrible moment. This shattering idealism, imagining the formless turmoil of life-changing sublimity, cannot be sustained, of course. You drive audiences mad. And there is more to the sublime than visceral spectacle. Another way of imagining a new world, or our old world enhanced in some way, was through the dream of redemption. One such vision is offered at the end of the second part of the play Faust by the romantic poet Goethe, and the precious words of hope evoking the transcendent power of what he called the eternal feminine as uttered by the mystical chorus. Berlioz never said this, but his friend Franz Liszt did, finding in these words the perfect ending to his visionary Faust symphony, resorting, as Beethoven had before him, to human voices. Next week, we focus on the individual performer and the rise of the virtuoso romantic artist. But now we leave you with that poetic vision from the end of Franz Liszt's Faust symphony, as Hans-Peter Blockwitz and the men of the Netherlands Radio Choir with the Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra under Ricardo Chailly perform the Chorus Mysticus. All that must disappear is but a parable. What lay beyond us here is made visible. Here deeds have understood words they were darkened by. Eternal womanhood draws us on high.
That first episode, The Revolutionary Sublime, from our series Music, Romanticism and the Sublime, was written and presented by Michael Lee. And the series continues next week when Michael discusses individualism and the emergence of new types of virtuosity in the Romantic era. You can listen back to the programmes via the RTE radio app or on the Lyric Features webpage. For copyright reasons, this series is not available to podcast.